I suppose prices affect all of us more and as intimately as anything that happens to us. We suffer price control as we suffered rationing and a lot of other things. Now we're told by a lot of business representatives that production and prosperity and everything would come if we just take the clamps off prices and let them go wherever they wanted to. We've got a price control system. Some people want it removed. What do you think about it, Mr. Hazlitt?
Well, I agree, Mr. Bryson, that the threat of inflation is very grave. But inflation, it seems to me, can be stopped only by dealing with its causes. The chief cause is the increase in the volume of money and credit in this country. This is more than three times as great as before the outbreak of the war.
That's inflation in itself, isn't it, Mr. Bryson?
Well, that is inflation. It has been brought about chiefly by the unbalanced budget. The next most important cause of high prices is the shortage of many goods. Now, price control, it seems to me, is a sham remedy for inflation because it does not deal with either of these causes. It does not reduce the volume of money or credit, and it does not increase the output of goods. On the contrary, its effect is often to restrict the output of goods. It attempts to deal merely with the symptoms of inflation, and so it diverts attention from the real cures.
And you think we've got inflation on the way in spite of price control?
Well, I think we have inflation here, and I think we ought to try to get rid of the price controls as soon as possible. We could have got rid of price control for everything except rents at the end of this June if the OPA had started to release controls immediately after the end of the Japanese war last August. But because it failed to do so, it may force us to make some extension of the controls. That extension, however, ought to be so contrived that it forces the OPA to taper off price controls very rapidly.
Mr. Bryson, there's a good many things Mr. Hazlitt said that I hope we get a chance to discuss before the program's over. But the first one I want to talk about is who it is that has too much money. He says that one of the reasons we face inflation is because we have too much money. I'm sure it isn't the workers in the cotton textile mills who are earning on the average $31.50 a week. It certainly isn't the workers in the work shirt industry. They make $20.73 a week, 59 cents an hour. That certainly isn't too much money. As a matter of fact, if you take all factory workers, including those that get good, higher rate of wages, the total factory payrolls have dropped since the end of 1943 by some 40%. The average
total factory payrolls, Mr. Montgomery, does that mean the average payment?
That's the total amount of money paid out in factory wages is now about 40% less than it was, Mr. Bryson, at the end of 1943.
And there are not 40% fewer people at work?
Well, it's about 30% fewer at work than they were in the year 1943. There were 14 million employed in factories then, and it's down to about 10 million now. So I don't know where this money is that's the cause of inflation. It certainly isn't the hands of a whole lot of poor people in this country and of low-salaried workers. To tell them that the money they have is the cause of inflation won't be very acceptable, I think.
Well, now we've got to deal with the fact, first, that the money has increased. The money supply of this country has more than tripled since December of 1939. And Mr. Eccles of the Federal Reserve Board the other day estimated that it's almost five times as great. Now, that money is pretty much spread around, and factory labor has a great deal of it. From January, we're not talking about how to redistribute the wealth of this country or anything else. We're discussing the question of inflation, what causes it and how it's brought about. It's caused primarily by an increase of money in relation to the supply of goods. Now, labor normally, over 25 years, from the period of 1919 to 1943, had an average of 70% of the income of the country. That's wages and salaries. Now, that money that has greatly increased. As a matter of fact, from January 1939 until July of 1945, factory payrolls, not factory payrolls, I'm sorry, weekly wages in factories had gone up almost exactly 100%. The exact figure was 99 9/10%. Now, some workers, of course, are much poorer off than others. I'm not arguing that.
I'm just saying that there
is more money in circulation.
Don't you think that's a fine thing, that factory workers' payrolls have gone up?
I'm not disputing that. I'm just saying that if their factory payrolls go up, which you seem to dispute that they hadn't done, that if they go up and the amount of goods does not go up in proportion, and you've got so much money, then prices are bound to go up by competitive bidding of people for goods. That's the answer to inflation.
Well, you don't disagree with me, do you, Mr. Hazlitt, that factory payrolls have dropped a great deal since the peak they reached during the war?
It seems to be a very evident issue of fact here between you two gentlemen. Have payrolls gone up or haven't they?
Well, payrolls have gone down, of course, since the peak period of the war. They've gone down from say, July 1945. But as a matter of fact, the automobile workers want to get the same weekly income for fewer hours. Now, what does that mean? That means that for producing fewer goods in fewer hours, they will get the same money income. Now, if they have the same money income trying to buy a smaller volume of goods, it means a higher price. That's all it means.
That means, well, Mr. Hazlitt, that they are contending. Is this right, Mr. Montgomery, that the workers say that they can have higher wages, but that prices can be kept down?
Yes, we think they not only can, but must have higher wages if people, that is the plain, the ordinary people that make up the country, that make up the markets for manufacturers, if you like, those people have got to have more money if we're going to be able to buy the goods that this country can produce. Mr. Hazlitt is talking about the need for getting the production up, and of course we all agree with that. But when we do, who is going to buy it? The government has been spending billions of dollars. I don't know, what is it, Mr. Hazlitt? $80 billion or more per year of our production has been for government account. Now, that's going to drop a great deal. Now, we want to keep on producing. We want people working like we found they could work during the war. But when they do, and the government is not buying the goods, who's going to buy them, Mr. Bryson, if people don't have higher wages to buy them with?
Who's going to buy them?
Well, now, here, Mr. Montgomery, while we're talking about how to stop inflation, Mr. Montgomery starts worrying about deflation. Mr. Montgomery starts worrying about how we're going to sell the goods. And the big problem before us is the fact that there's so much pressure to get goods. Such an enormous pressure to get goods, such a surplus of buying power that goods are tend to skyrocket. Now, why start worrying now about people having enough money to buy goods when the whole problem is that they've got too much money in relation to the supply of goods?
Well, you see, all these wage increases you hear about, Mr. Hazlitt, are not trying to increase the amount of money the workers have. They are trying to maintain somewhere near what they earned during the war. And as a matter of fact, they won't do that. This wage pattern that you've heard about will not suffice to maintain weekly earnings of the family where it was during the war. But I'd like to get this down to a concrete thing. There's too much money, you say, afloat. Now, here's average weekly earnings of factory workers is about $40 a week. How much of that $40 do you want to take away from the average family there?
Well, I'm not going into the question of who should get what. I'm not going into the question of the distribution of wealth in this country. I think that's another question. I'm talking about the fact that factory payrolls, for example, have gone up enormously. They went up, as I say, at the peak at 100% from January 1939. Now, you can't have that happen and not have an increase in prices.
Well, you say the way to control inflation is to have less money in circulation, get some of this money out of the way. Isn't that right?
That's right.
Now, the factory workers have $40 a week on the average. Do you want to take some of that away, or don't you?
Let's take not what they have on the average. Let's take what labor gets on the whole. Labor gets on the whole 70% of the income of this country. So that 70% of your money is in the hands of labor, and that is the money that is pushing up. It isn't labor alone. It's all incomes that are pushing prices up.
We've got to get that figure down. Mr. Montgomery, that 70% of our income goes to workers now?
Yes, I guess that's about right. I think it ought to be that, or ought to be still higher. If we're going to be able to buy the goods we can produce. See, it's the money, after all, that goes to labor and the money that farmers get that provides the basic market for the things that we all produce. Why won't you answer my question? Do you want to take away part of that $40 a week? Or is it somebody else's money you want to take away?
I'll be very glad to answer that question. Once you have had an unbalanced budget, of the extent to which our budget has been unbalanced, then you cannot squeeze down again. One trouble about inflation is that you cannot deflate without great hardship and without creating unemployment and all sorts of hardships. What I'm trying to do is to stop inflating. We have now more than three times the amount of money in circulation that we had at the beginning of the war. I wouldn't like to see it go up to four or five times. What happens is that the money becomes worthless. That's what's happening all over the world. There's a worldwide inflation on. And you go to a country like Romania, where they've increased the money thousands of times. You don't say that the Romanians, that such and such a Romanian who's in a textile mill is getting too much, but he's not getting anything for his money. If prices are shooting up and he hasn't got the goods, we've got to measure wealth in terms of goods, not in terms of salaries or wages.
Well, I'll tell you one place you might balance the budget. You know, last fall, one of the first things we did after the end of the war was to cut off the excess profits tax of corporations. I understand that that will save corporations during 1946 some $2.5 billion. I think that's the difference it'll make to them in taxes. Now, that unbalances the budget, doesn't it? To cut down the tax income by $2.5 billion. Would you recommend restoring the excess profits tax? We could get together on that, I think.
I certainly wouldn't, because in that particular tax, I think if it had been kept, you would have choked off far more production before, and you would have increased inflation.
Well, whose money do you want to take?
It's cutting down on expenditures. We're having expenditures of the nature of $31 billion in a peacetime year. $31 billion is seven times the tax income that we had in any one year before the war. And that is a terrific amount. We can cut down on those expenditures. There's no use going into details, because then you're getting into other questions. You're getting into the merits of other questions.
Well,
we have to cut down the expenditures.
You're talking about government expenditures.
I'm talking about government expenditures.
Well, I think government expenditures are being cut very rapidly, aren't they, since the end of the war, and will continue to be for the next 2 or 3 years. I remember the national budget projected for the next 2 years is going to be a very great reduction in government spending.
We're still having a deficit of the present 6 months that's running on official estimates in the neighborhood of about $10 billion. And that's for this 6 months alone. And the forthcoming, the 1947 year, we have a deficit estimated at $4 billion. And that's a greater deficit than we had in any year prior to the war. Now, we can't continue these deficits. We can't put money in and then talk about combating inflation. It becomes a sham fight when we do that.
Mr. Hazlitt, your position seems to be that price controls are only a control over the symptom of inflation, and that they should be abandoned because if you don't have real control of inflation, they do more harm than good. Is that right?
That is right. There would be certain imaginable conditions under which price control could be defended. If, for example, during the coming year you had price controls and you said we are going to cut down the amount of money and credit in this country, and we are going to have the controls flexible enough so that they won't restrict production at any point, we're going to allow production, and we're going not only to balance the budget but overbalance the budget and reduce the amount of money outstanding, then you would have a case for continuing your general price fixing, because you could say that at the end of that year prices would be lower. But I think there's no prospect whatever that prices will be lower at the end of another year of price fixing.
So
because the pressure will be for another year's price fixing again.
So as things stand, you in favor now of removing most of the price controls?
I would be in favor of forcing the OPA to taper down its price controls.
Well, I can tell you, Mr. Bryson, just how that would cut expenditures. Now, Mr. Hazlitt says he wants to cut expenditures. You take off price controls, everybody knows what's going to happen to prices, and I don't think Mr. Hazlitt will dispute that. I was reading here in the New York Times a statement by Mr. Cannon. People remember him. He's the head of the Cannon Mills Company, makes these Cannon towels. He was talking to a Senate committee down there in Washington yesterday, the day before, and he was urging these price controls be reduced or taken off, and he said that if they were taken off, there would be an immediate increase in production, he says. And consumer prices would go up because they are 18 to 25% under what they should be. Now, there's Mr. Cannon's testimony, for example, and I think everybody agrees that prices would jump up a very great deal, perhaps 20 or 30% if we took all the controls off. Now, whose expenditures would that cut, Mr. Bryson? I'll tell you whose expenditures would cut. It would cut the expenditures of these people I'm talking about with $25 a week income. That would be putting rationing back on the brutalitarian basis, the kind of rationing that makes the low-income family do without things. That's what taking price controls off would do. You'd cut expenditures, all right, but you'd cut it at the bottom where it hurts and where family expenditures can't afford to be cut, where the living people are getting right now is an intolerable living for us to permit any kind of Americans to have.
Well, as long as you talk about prices and refuse to talk about goods, you can make a wonderful case for price control. But we can do what has been done everywhere in Europe. We can keep down prices, and nobody will get the goods at those prices. The goods won't be made. You'll have rationing, but they won't get it. And then all that will happen will be the growth of the black market. Now, I doubt very much that there would be anything like a 25% increase in the general level of prices if we took all price controls off tomorrow. I don't think it would be anything like that. First of all, you've got to remember that you have an official index number, which is not a real index number. These official index numbers have ceased to represent the real situation, and the labor itself has argued that, because they take simply goods that don't exist and that can't be obtained in volume. Now, as far as this alleged figure of 25% is concerned, I don't know what cannon towels ought to sell for, or any textiles, or any at all. But
well,
I do say this.
If you want to take price control off, you don't care what they sell for.
I do say this, that if any manufacturer is selling, is asked to sell goods 25% below what it costs them to make it, then I see no reason why any individual should be forced to subsidize people as an individual. If people are going to be subsidized, let the government do it by its own subsidies, not by private persons. But as a matter of fact, if you try to do that, you just won't get the goods. And that's what's happening all over the country.
Well,
We're not getting the goods.
I'm awfully glad you state that, because I read that in the New York Times and all the other papers all the time. Story after story, Mr. Bryson. From some merchant or some manufacturer.
Don't credit me with Mr. Hazlitt's opinion.
No, I'm just telling you, Mr. Bryson, because maybe you don't read the New York Times as closely as I do. But all the other papers, all this, I call it the crybaby chorus. This talk that price controls and rising costs are killing profits so that manufacturers can't produce.
You think they're not retarding production?
That is the worst swindle that's ever been put over on the American public. Business has been more profitable during the war. It is still more profitable, and in 1946, it's going to have the most profitable take-home profits in American history. And I don't base that only on government estimates. I read that in Business Week. Now, is that a radical paper? Is it run by government people? Certainly not. It's not run by labor people. People, heaven knows.
Well, Mr. Montgomery, what you're saying is that when a manufacturer complains that he's being asked to produce something for less than it cost him to make it, he simply isn't talking the truth.
What I'm saying,
you know that he isn't talking the truth, because you know what the real facts are, and you know he isn't telling the truth.
What I'm saying
so
is
that although there are thousands of complaints by manufacturers, they are all in a conspiracy for telling lies, and none of them can be trusted. Is that what your statement
what
is?
What I'm saying, Mr. Hazlitt, is that when a manufacturer, time after time, says he isn't making any money, that you believe him almost every time, and I do very seldom. Now take Mr. Cannon in the cotton textile industry. It so happens the cotton textile industry has been making profits at the rate of 13 times what they made in the years 36 to 39. That's based on figures that the government has there for a large sample of these cotton mills.
Profits on what, Mr. Montgomery? Profits on their investment, profits on their volume,
their total dollar profits before taxes.
If their profit was a dollar in earlier, then it could be $13 now.
That's right. 13 times what they made before
the war.
Yes,
but profits can go to a negative sum, Ms. Montgomery. It can go to nothing at all. Profits went to a negative sum in 1932.
In 36-39, they were making a profit. As a matter of fact, 36-39, if you want to get
36-39 was
minute,
not a very
just,
prosperous period. We had 10 million unemployed in that period.
I've heard that before, and it so happens you have to go back to 1920.
That's the CIO figures on the unemployment in that
Please
period.
Please don't interrupt. Let me
ask
the question. You have to go back in the cotton textile industry to 1920 to find 4 years that were as profitable in terms of return on investment as the years 36-39 in the cotton textile industry. Now, I've studied those figures, and if you can dispute them, go ahead, but I assure you, I'm not dreaming this up out of the air.
Yes, I'd be glad to dispute those figures.
Take the department stores, too. We hear them through the National Retail Dry Goods Association. They're always down in Washington telling how they're being ruined by price control, Mr. Bryson. It just makes your heart ache to hear it. But they put out their own figures on what their profits are. They publish them every year, and there again, it's something like 13 times what they made before the war. These people have never been so profitable. It's astonishing how they can keep on saying on the top of this very profitable situation that price control is ruining them.
Well, that's a straight issue of fact, gentlemen. Making money or isn't it?
I'd like to take up that question. I cited before the question that from 19...
Over a 25-year period, ending in about 1943, labor income was about 70% of the income of the country. Mr. Montgomery accepted that figure. Well, now, in that same period, corporation net profits averaged less than 5% of the total income of the country. Now, it so happens that in the Department of Commerce bulletin of the last month, a survey of current business, they have an estimate of what profits were in 1944. And they show that the corporation profits in that time, according to them, were 9% of the total corporate income. Not of the country's income, but of the total corporate income. 9% was net profits. 61% of that, however, went to labor. So that labor was getting about six times as much as the stockholders were from the corporate profits. Practically all the rest, with some overhead allowance, went in taxes.
That's fine, so, don't you think? Don't you think labor ought
to get a lot
more?
I'm not arguing that, but here is what you're arguing, Mr. Montgomery. You don't want apparently any ceilings whatever on wages. You, the automobile workers, who are in the upper third of income receivers in this country, want to have themselves perfectly free for collective bargaining.
That's right.
When any attempt is made to say what wages should be, they say that this is a terrific attempt to take away their liberties and so on. Mm-hmm. And I agree with that. I think that's fine. But why? But you just want liberty for the automobile workers, and no one else. In other words, they can fix their own wages under collective bargaining. But prices ought to be fixed by the government. The government is to tell this fellow, you've got to charge a dollar for that, and if you charge a dollar and a quarter, I'll put you in jail. Now you have no objection to that, whatever.
None whatever.
But you'd have a terrific objection to it in labor, wouldn't you?
I'm awfully glad you brought up the auto workers, because I'd be too modest to bring it in myself. But I want to remind you that the GM workers for the last 5 months have been trying to get a wage increase, as you know. And time again, we have said to the corporation, we don't want a wage increase that will cause you to raise your prices. You sit down and show us what you can pay without raising your prices, and we'll scale our wage demands down.
How much profit are you going to allow, GM? You must have some amount that you're going to let them have. How much is it?
We've been saying all along that they could pay us a big wage increase without any increase in prices and make larger profits than they ever made in their history.
Well, you must have some figure that you're going to allow GM to make. What is that figure?
We'd be willing.
You have to have some basis to figure what they can afford to pay. It must be something that you're going to allow them.
We'd be willing to talk with General Motors about that.
You'd be willing to fix their profit for them,
wouldn't you? No, we'd be willing to bargain about how much they could afford to pay and how they think they'd come out in terms of profit. They'd argue for their profit, and we'd argue for our wages. That wouldn't be fixing their profits. You happen to know that in 1941, General Motors' profits before taxes were almost exactly equal to the wages they were paying to their hourly rate workers? That's how profitable that industry is.
I know that over a long period of time, General Motors has paid about five times as much to labor as it has paid in dividends, or I think that sort.
Yes, but wages come out of profits before taxes, not out of profits after taxes. A great deal of General Motors' profits been plowed back into the business, as you know.
Well, isn't this, again, a straight difference as to a matter of fact here, gentlemen? Mr. Hazlitt says that production is being retarded because price controls are in the hands of the government, while labor is insisting upon higher wages. And you, Mr. Montgomery, are saying that production is not retarded. Production is enormous anyhow and would be bigger in 1946 than ever before.
Well, I'll say that during the war, it certainly was not retarded. As Mr. Bowles has told the public over and over again, we had much tighter price control during this war than during the last.
Well, we had wage control, too, then, didn't we?
Yes, and production went up a great deal more in this war than it ever did before. Matter of fact, we made this marvelous, record-breaking increase in output during the war years under the strictest price control we've ever had.
Now, that isn't exactly so. The increase in production was an increase in production of war goods.
That's
munition.
Right.
That's where the heavy production was.
And
the government bought that. And the government paid what it had to pay to get that, and on a more or less on a cost-plus system. That wasn't the price-fixed part. The price-fixed was in the consumer's goods, and consumer's goods went down. Your big production increase, whether it was a big production increase, and it may have been in tonnage terms to a certain extent,
take agriculture.
was in weapons of war, which the government bought directly. That's a different thing.
Take farm products. We had
farm products have been soaring in price. Those fellas
All things have gone up some in
Well,
price.
Yes, but they, the but farm products haven't been held down. They have a parity scheme to push them up.
Are you saying, Mr. Hazlitt? We had, just a minute. We had price control of farm products during the war. Now, don't let's get that far off base. I mean,
well,
you know
what,
perfectly
you know perfectly well what farm prices are
compared
with what they were before the war.
Is it your position, Mr. Hazlitt, that during the war we had price control over consumers' goods, and that consumers' goods were not produced as a result of price control?
Well, we didn't want to produce them during the war. That was the whole thing. We wanted to concentrate on war production. But the moment the Japanese war came to an end, then our problem was reversed. We wanted to get as much consumers' goods as possible. And that meant that we should have changed our policy in order to do that. And that is precisely what we failed to do.
Well, I want to come back to your question, Mr. Bryson, as to whether we're... Mr. Hazlitt and I disagree as to whether or not price control is preventing production. Now, what I said was that price control should not be preventing production. I challenge this claim that so many manufacturers and trade associations are making, that price control is squeezing their profits and they can't afford to produce. I say that in general is a wholesale swindle that's being put over on the people, and I think the newspapers are helping a great deal to put it over, because anytime any trade source comes out with a long statement that they're being ruined by price control, why, sure enough, it'll get three quarters or a full column of stuff. Now,
well, the CIO statements get lots of space, too.
Well, if you try to follow how much we get,
we
how much they get...
Are we to decide who's right and who's wrong and deciding the space? The newspaper isn't run that way. Newspaper isn't.
All right. Now, let me get back to an answer to Mr. Bryson's question. I think it's true that price control in many places is, at present, holding up production. And here's why I think so. I think that many of these big industries... who met here together, by the way, on January 9th at the Waldorf Astoria under the invitation of General Motors Corporation. Mr. Wilson testified to that in Detroit a few weeks ago. I think these big industries saw what the steel industry got away with. They went down there and practically hijacked the government and said, we won't even enter into collective bargaining with our workers unless you give us a price increase. So Mr. Snyder and the government said, all right, how's $4? And they said, nothing doing. We're going to keep this industry shut down. We want more than $4.
Well, in other words, labor is always virtuous and always tells the truth.
Well,
but any businessman is always telling a lie and always trying to put something over because he's a businessman.
Well, I don't say it's because he's a businessman. I'm only talking about what seems to be the fact when they talk about what's happening to profits.
These direct... differences on what the facts actually are, gentlemen, leave the public, I think, somewhat confused. Maybe there is more than some of us used to think.
We are sorry that time does not permit the complete presentation of the discussion, should price controls be maintained. Today's program was originally heard at home on the People's Platform. The opinions expressed in these broadcasts are the opinions of the speakers. It is not to be inferred that the War Department endorses any of the views expressed. Listen next week for another Heard at Home broadcast. This is the Armed Forces Radio Service.